Hi everyone and welcome back to episode 3 of season 2 of the Healthcare India podcast with me Dr. Vikram Venkateshwaran coming to you live from Bangalore, which is for all practical purposes the health tech capital of India. First of all, wishing you a very very happy Diwali. For those of you who celebrate Diwali, it was a fantastic celebration across the country, and I think the 2 years of pandemic and the restrictions thereof were totally off, and I think almost everybody got some good time off, spent time with family, with friends, and celebrated the festival across the country and also abroad. Of course, the Diwali celebrations were highlighted by two unrelated incidents. One was India's victory over Pakistan in the T20 World Cup. It was not the final. A lot of my friends who don't follow cricket asked me, was that the final and did we win the cup? No, that was our first match. Tense match, but first match, and victory against Pakistan is always sweet. The second thing was the elevation of Rishi Sunak as the first Indian, person of Indian origin, to become the Prime Minister of UK. And this is a significant moment because in my lifetime, I did not think this would happen. So today's podcast, we're going to focus on two things. One is we're going to focus on disruptive technologies and how disruption in healthcare, though promises much, but nothing really happens. And let's discuss why that happens. And this could be true of many other industries, but we'll look at specifically in healthcare and see why some of the technologies that had great promise, great hope, great potential, never lived up to that expectation. But we're going to start off with something more controversial. A few weeks ago, I think a couple of weeks ago, or was it last week, when the Global Hunger Index was released by these two non-profits, one from Germany and one from Ireland. And believe me, if you were in India during Diwali, you may not have realized it, but India seems to be having a serious hunger problem, according to this report. And you know, those of us who've been in India for so long, we've been through the ups and downs, we realize what hunger is, and we've seen it in the public distribution system, in the public health system, and working in far-flung remote areas, in medical camps and school dental programs and health programs. I've never seen personally hunger of that kind, the way that's manifested in the report. And maybe my view is very, very limited to the areas I've been to. I've spent a lot of my time in the South. Of course, I've worked in rural Karnataka. I've worked in rural Delhi. But I've not seen hunger of this kind. But the report is produced by two very well-known NGOs, so I'm assuming there's a certain degree of element of truth to it. The way India reacted to this report is the way we react to any report. We dismissed it. We said the parameters were wrong, and which could be the truth. I'm not denying it. Now, what was interesting about this was, I would have let it slide, but for I read an article by Chetan Bhagat, who I rate very highly as a management guru and less as an author. But anyway, he came out swinging like a true MBA, proving his credentials from IIM Ahmedabad, that there was something off about the way the report was structured. And that piqued my interest, so I went into it. So I went and downloaded the report and read through it. It's a pretty interesting read, pretty gloomy picture, if you ask me. It looks like we are in a lot of trouble from a hunger perspective. And one of the interesting things I noticed was the most of the Western world, that is US, Canada, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, they were not in the report, right? There's no hunger problem there, which is, I think, a big fallacy. But anyway, most of Southeast Asia, Eastern Europe, including Russia, despite the conflict, are all green, which is fine, no issues. South America and Eastern Europe, including Russia, were all green. South Africa and Southeast Asia were moderate. That means, no, they're not totally green, but they're fine, they should be okay. And Central Africa, the situation was alarming. But India, along with certain other countries, we were in serious trouble according to Global Hunger Index. And I was like, why is it that suddenly India is in serious trouble, right? And so I went into the dynamics, and there are four parameters that they use to devise this report. One is called undernourishment. The parameters of which are provided by the Food and Agriculture Organization, a part of United Nations. The second is child mortality. Now, child mortality, those of you who've been in India know that mother and child policies are laid down by the government of India. They're strictly followed and monitored at various levels. So under 5 mortality, that is what they mean by child mortality, as opposed to infant mortality, which is child death at birth. Now, the under 5 mortality is collected by something called the United Nations Interagency for Mortality Estimation. And that was the second agency that got involved. But the third agency that got involved, which is my favorite agency for creating trouble in India, is UNICEF. I have never seen UNICEF being fair to India. So I was very intrigued that they were responsible for two of the parameters. And those are the two parameters that took India's score down and gave us an alarming or a serious situation ranking there. And one was child stunting, and the other was child wasting. Now, child stunting means that if it's 2 basis points below what they believe the child growth should be, by UNICEF standards, then that's called child stunting. And child wasting is if the weight is below 2 basis points of what UNICEF deems them to be. Now, both are interesting parameters. I don't know who exactly compiled this report. I don't see an auditor signing off on the report, and I don't think any of the big consulting firms are involved. But the way I look at the report, and if I see the 3 organizations involved, the one I have maximum trouble with is UNICEF. And UNICEF single-handedly managed 2 parameters. And interestingly, in both these parameters, India does very poorly. So we are not undernourished. And our infant mortality, under 5 mortality, is better than what it should be. I'm not saying that's acceptable, but it's better than it should be. But we are stunted, and we are wasted as children. And I'm assuming that continues. I mean, I don't know how suddenly, if you are wasted as a child and your weight is low and your height is low, then how as adults they suddenly catch up with their height? Because I don't think we have a problem of that once they become, once they grow up. On the other hand, we have an obesity problem. So there's something not right about it. So for once, Chetan Bhagat and me are on the same page. Something needs to be done about it. Somebody needs to look into it. The government of India obviously feels this is off. I don't know what's the sample size. Somebody told me the sample size was 3,000. For a country of 1.4 billion, 3,000 sample size is too short. Somebody else said this was government of India data and we had 6 lakh sample size and UNICEF just compiled it together. Well, they compiled it and they benchmarked it against a standard. Now that's the standard that's causing trouble. And I looked through the entire report and almost every country in Africa and Asia has done poorly on these 2 standards. So what's the plan next? Is it to feed us more proteins, make more food available in India? I don't think we have a food problem. We've been exporting food for a very long time. Actually, India made up for the deficiency in wheat exports due to the Russia-Ukraine crisis. So I don't think production is a problem. We've got record productions even this year. Maybe distribution is a problem. Maybe, I don't know. But India always had midday meal schemes. Of course, 2 years of the pandemic, we did not have schools running. Maybe that was an issue. Maybe, possible. But the schools are up now, and the midday meal schemes and the controversies are back. So should I assume by next year we should be fine? We don't have a serious problem. The other thing that the Modi government did very well was they gave free food to most people below poverty line. And this was arranged through the public distribution system. And it was direct deposit into the households. So were the families not feeding the children? That's a social issue more than an economic or a political issue. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. But this is something we need to look into. And UNICEF remains a problem area for me. It's not the first time they've done this. and it may not be the last time, but there's no smoke without fire, so it's worth investigating. Maybe next year when the schools are running 1 year of school and hey, guess what, we never had a problem, it is just the schools were shut, that's it, it was COVID. Once the midday meal schemes are back into the children, the height catches up, their weight catches up, everything catches up, and then we have other problem, they're obese. Anyway, so that's the Global Hunger Index. If you want to check the report out, I'll have the link in the description. And it'd be good to get your opinion. I mean, just seriously think about it. Don't just listen to this podcast and go back to your normal life. Just think about it. Do you see a hunger problem anywhere around you? Especially, you know, close to the urban or semi-urban or rural areas below poverty line people. Just think about it. Is it really happening? Are children not getting fed? Then we should do something about it. But I doubt that's the case. So that's one. That's the more controversial one. Now, the interesting part is I had the opportunity to participate in a workshop in one of the leading digital technology companies in healthcare. And one of the things we discussed there as a group, you know, we had people from academia, people from industry, we had thought leaders, doctors, oncologists, etc., etc. And one of the things we discussed was why is it not simple for disruptive technologies to come in and disrupt the industry? And that's a problem everywhere, right? I'm not saying it's just a healthcare problem. So if you look at something like blockchain, right, my favorite topic, blockchain has huge potential. And I was just finishing up an article on blockchain and its implications on data privacy in healthcare especially. And I look at blockchain and I said, why did not blockchain, which is such a fascinating technology, such a promising disruptive technology, why did it not disrupt healthcare? And to discuss the topic, I started looking at it from a different lens, right? So if you look at another technology or another technology framework, which is your telemedicine, how did it disrupt healthcare? Now, telemedicine had three aspects to it. There was a technology aspect, obviously there was video conferencing, IoT, cloud. Then there was a process and protocols that now telemedicine was acceptable. There were Medical Council of India and Niti Aayog guidelines on it. What could be prescribed, what can't be prescribed, how should the prescription look like, what are the disease conditions you can't discuss. For example, you can't prescribe antidepressants. You can't do certain kind of sleep medicines over telemedicine. That is a good protocol. And there was also this requirement for the telemedicine discussion or the appointment to be recorded. And in certain cases, that inserted into longitudinal record of the patient, right? Which continues as a health record for the patient. So that's your process and protocol coming into place. And the third thing they did was they did a lot of, the Medical Council of India especially did a lot of training for doctors and nurses of how to manage patients on telemedicine, how to talk to them over video conferencing, how to interact with them, what were the guidelines, what are the do's and don'ts, etc. So that's how telemedicine, which was in the running for the last 20 years, in many ways it was illegal and suddenly became legal, suddenly became part of our daily healthcare system. Now, if you look at something like blockchain, now blockchain is, as you know, is another word for distributed databases. It has cryptography, it has encryption, and there is also, it relies on certain basic technologies like Solidity. And I think we, in healthcare at least, we missed it right from the word go. First of all, there was no use case for blockchain that was coming out. Cryptocurrency remains the biggest use case for blockchain. And a lot of healthcare organizations were hoping that we would move beyond cryptocurrency. And we look at things like financial services and fintech, where the cryptocurrency boom is essentially centered. But nobody moved beyond it. No use cases came out specifically for healthcare. There were a few around supply chain, especially around track and trace of drugs, you know, bill of materials and inter-country remittances when you import medical equipment. But the core healthcare things, right? Like somebody wanted to put patient records on blockchain, which was an interesting idea, but all of these were never developed into use cases. They continued to remain as theories, or at best in a silo, in a sandbox environment. No service provider actually worked with a hospital to actually look at a use case, to build a use case, and then take that use case to production. And it never happened. Because that did not happen, there was no protocols or processes even discussed. How do I make a blockchain transaction part of the medical record or the patient record? How do I put it as part of my daily briefing or my daily, you know, discussions that doctors have among themselves or doctors have with the patient? How can I put the prescription on a blockchain? And one thing interesting is, you know, it took a long time for auditors and the governance, you know, leaders to accept ERP. A similar impact to make blockchain admissible or as a part of their compliance, that a report out of blockchain will be signed off by the auditor. Those things were never even discussed. They were never even started. We continue to discuss the technology piece of it, which is great. And almost every CTO worth his salt had something on blockchain, or at least had an opinion, which is fantastic. But we never moved beyond that. And here the fault lies not with the technologies, not with the doctors, not with the hospitals, not with the healthcare industry, but with our understanding of how disruptive technologies work and how they become disruptive. Otherwise, till then, it's a technology. So if you look at disruption caused by technology, first of all, technology by itself cannot cause disruption. There has to be adoption. And for adoption, there are two key parameters, right? One is obviously the use cases that you develop. And when I say use cases, I mean how it will be used, what will be the protocols, what will be the process, how will it be integrated in the business flow or the clinical flow of the organization. Those are very important. And then in addition to that, you need to have the right kind of talent. So when you talk about blockchain talent, we never had any pure play blockchain talent, both on the technical side as well as on the functional side. So we had people who were good at Java, who also did blockchain on the side. We had people who were .NET full stack developers who also did blockchain on the side. Or we had cryptographic experts who did encryption, who were in cybersecurity, and they also understood how blockchain could be used. If this was the scene on the technology side, the functional side was even worse. And whoever was a pure plain blockchain developer were picked up by all the cryptocurrency exchanges and developers. So we really didn't have any functional experts or technology experts. With no talent and no strategy for a talent, no policy for a talent, how is the technology going to be disruptive? Because somebody has to develop those. So I think when it comes to disruptive technologies, it's good to talk about all of them. But until we have the use case, people, process, protocols in place, it will never be a reality. It'll also be an also-ran. And today everybody is focused on AI. Well, good luck. We probably will see a lot of narrow use AI, but when it comes to general purpose AI, we will still struggle. We are still struggling with 5G and understanding what are the implications of 5G in healthcare. Blockchain remains an unfulfilled promise. And the difference between adoption and successful adoption remains the process, protocols, and people. And all we have to do is look at cloud. Cloud as a technology was available for about 15 years, maybe longer. But cloud as a successful adoption in the industry started only in the last 7 to 8 years, and healthcare was because of the pandemic. So we need the protocols and people and use cases in place. We need the right talent. And without these two things, it's not possible. So what I'll recommend is to think about it. Let's discuss. If you have any ideas, do reach out to me at drvikram@healthcare-in-india.net. Do reach out to me on Twitter as well at drvikram. As always, I'll be more than happy to take your suggestions, questions. And if you have an idea of how disruption can be taken mainstream, do let me know. And I'll be happy to discuss that. Till then, stay safe. Happy Diwali once again. And have a great rest of the year.